so I can take what I did for dental and rewrite it as chiropractic, and vice versa. Sometimes there's length of time or renewal issues, and after all these years, I'm still learning something new, finding new ways that people can take advantage of me. And so there's a new clause in my contract this year that's a resale right restriction that essentially says they can't take the work that was prepared for their use to promote their business and bundle it up and turn around and sell it to others, such as others in other parts of the country, in their industry. And so there's a prohibition against that. So those are, there's three of the six, big contract issues. And Lori, I think we had a question about one of the three.
Yeah, actually Maggie Dennison had a couple of questions about ownership issues in particular. For example, how do you handle copyright issues if you're using subcontractors?
I've not personally, I've done very little of that and had even less luck with it. but I have on occasion done it. But 99% of all the copy I deliver to clients, I actually write. And I make that a selling point.
Right.
But if you do use subcontractors, you want that to be pure work for hire. And you want to own all the rights. They own none. And further, they should also sign confidentiality agreements, non-compete agreements. Those clauses ought to be in your agreement with them as well. The fourth item, then, in the contract is compensation.
Uh-huh.
How much you're getting paid, when you're getting paid. And I'll make a big entrepreneurial comment about that. I talk a lot about it when I talk to entrepreneurs about money, and that is there's a single simple difference between the way rich people get paid and poor people get paid. Poor people get paid after they do the work. Rich people get paid before they do the work.
Oh.
And so,
light bulb.
Single mom with two kids who's working in a factory over here, she works all week and then she gets a paycheck. So she's always a week behind, and she ain't ever going to get ahead.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Guy who digs the ditch and lays the bricks and does the work to put up a building, he gets paid the same way. He works all week or he works for 2 weeks, and then he gets a check for what he just did. Donald Trump gets paid for his money on that building when he agrees to let them put his name on it before they have even done the plan. So rich people get paid before they do the work, poor people get paid after they do the work. My contracts are typically either third. Third of the fee at time of contract, third of the fee at an agreed upon benchmark or date,
right.
And the last third at an agreed upon benchmark or date. Sometimes for very complex, elaborate, and expensive projects, I have a $140,000 copywriting project in house right now, and the payment is in six installments. But for the most part, I'm doing thirds.
Right.
And the benchmarks for me are usually first draft, finished copy, and first use. And I'm a two-draft guy. If a project requires going back and forth more than twice, it's probably going to be the last time I'm going to work with that client.
Right.
So there's, you know, money at the delivery of the first drafts. There's money at delivery of the finished copy. And if I'm stretching installments, and then there's going to be delay because they're going to have weeks or months into converting the copy into the thing that they're actually going to use, there may be a final payment triggered by first use. Then there's forfeiture of partials. It's an important thing to have in a contract when you're taking payments. And that is, if they stop the project at some point along the way, whatever they've paid up to that point, and if you wish, a kill fee prescribed over and above it must be paid. But they are not in any circumstances getting back the money they have already paid. And then there's royalties, of course, and how those are paid. And my contracts have language, you asked earlier, do you know they're going to pay you, and how do you know they don't steal?
Right.
And for the most part, you don't. It has a lot to do with the selection of the client, the control of the client, the continuing relationship. And my theory is that most of them steal a little. Most accidentally, just bad bookkeeping, more so than intent. But I don't mind them swiping a little. I wind them swiping a lot. And so there's controls, and so there's a clause that says I have the right to come and audit their books and to take a look at their credit card slips or their bank statements or their shipping records or their ad placements. And again, when you're integrally involved in what they're doing, nobody can say, for example, run the same ad 5 months in a row in five magazines and tell you that they sold six units.
Right.
You know, nobody's that nuts. So they may be able to steal a little, but they can't steal a lot. And so your royalties, how you get paid, when you get paid, what accounting they show you when they pay you, and what your rights for verification are.
How do you verify, Dan, by the way?
Well,
if you do.
Fortunately, I've never to this day felt there was a situation egregious enough to enforce the clause.
Uh-huh.
Never. But the clause says I or a representative, meaning an accountant or CPA or whatever, can go in there and audit their books. And if there's a discrepancy, they pay the cost of the audit. And so, you know, depending on the nature of the business, you're going to be looking at bank statements, checking account records, shipping records, purchase order, what they, the stuff they ordered from the vendor that turns into the thing that they sold. I've never had to do it. I've had to threaten it a couple of times, and suddenly better accounting appeared, but I've never had to do it.
That's good.
And then the fifth item in the contract is the timetable. What's the schedule? When are they going to get what? And it's very important to resist the tendency to promise what you can't do. Because, of course, everybody wants everything yesterday.
Yeah, they do.
And we can't blame them. But they can't have it. I just wrote a contract today, and the guy desperately wants a launch in December. And I understand he wants a launch in December. But he's getting finished work January 1. And I'm not going to promise what I can't do. And if it costs the client or the project, that's okay. There's another bus coming. But you do not want to be in a position where you are over-promising and under-delivering. You should also have a weasel clause. That's what the attorneys call it.
What is that?
Well, in this case, the weasel clause says that your ability to beat the deadlines that are listed in the contract in part relies upon prompt response and cooperation from the client. And if approvals are unreasonably withheld or delays occur in their response, you're not liable.
So it's not your problem if they don't get back to you.
That's correct. And then sixth, and this is pretty important, and a lot of people leave it out, and it's really important when you're doing business in certain product categories, is indemnity and liability limitation. And so at bare minimum, you want the client acknowledging that you're not practicing law and you are not responsible for what you delivering, for what you deliver to them being legal. That's their responsibility.
Oh, okay.
And so I don't know enough about your business to make the determination of whether or not you're complying with all applicable federal, state, local laws. Your job, not mine. And a liability limitation, there's different ways to do it. The current language that I use has all these disclaimers about how I'm not liable at all. And the final liability limitation is in no way, shape, or form can I be held liable for an amount greater than the fee.
Uh-huh.
It's certain categories, say weight loss and nutrition.
Right.
You got to think long and hard about whether you should be named as additional insureds on their liability policies, whether they should have advertising liability, you should think about whether you should buy consultant liability insurance, which fortunately is dirt cheap. And the sixth thing then is these liability limitations and this indemnity clause, where they indemnify you against any costs or liabilities that arise through their use of what you give them.
And Dan, did you have an attorney write this bid up for you?
No, actually, I'm a plain English guy.
Okay.
And so this is all School of Hard Knocks stuff, or lifted and cut and pasted stuff, and probably half of it was there from the very beginning, and half of it has evolved.
Uh-huh.
And at times in different business environments where I do have an attorney do the contract, I then rewrite the contract in plain English and make the attorney sign off on it. Because if you have too many damn whereases and thereases in it, you know, you make life unnecessarily unpleasant.
For sure. That's for sure. We also have a question from Diane Conklin, who wants to know if you use the same contract with every client.
Almost. Essentially, I have a template. And so there's a standard contract template in the computer, and there's about 25 stock paragraphs. And some contracts get them all, some contracts only get some of them. And then it's basically fill in the blank assembled for the client.
Okay.
The part that has to be done from scratch each time is the project, just a description.
Right.
But almost everything else is boilerplate, and most of mine run between 2 and 3 pages.
Oh, that is pretty just plain English. If you can get it down that low, that's pretty good. Well, I know we're going to send a checklist out to everybody on the call, but is it possible to actually get a copy of one of your contracts?
You can hire me to write copy.
Wait a second.
Look, I always resist doing it, and in a sense, each one is at least slightly different. And, of course, I'm not in the business of practicing law or writing contracts for others. But I kind of knew you were going to ask.
I'm dying to see.
So I'll pick a compromise point. Everybody that gets the resources we talked about earlier tonight, I'll pull a very recent one of the more elaborate and complete contracts, black out the client identity, the dollar amounts, the stuff that is specific, and I'll send everybody a copy of the contract with the caveat that it's given as, for example, and sample purposes, not to verbatim become yours. And should it verbatim become yours, I accept no responsibility whatsoever. But everybody who gets the resources that we talked about tonight, we'll send them a contract as well.
That's awesome. And
I'll send it in print. I don't want it circulating on the internet either.
Yeah, that's a good idea. That's a really good idea. Very smart. Well, we have about, thank you, by the way. That's awesome. Not something you can just find anywhere. So we have 15 minutes left, actually 16 minutes left for some questions. So I want to open up the lines and see how everyone's doing. Everyone might want to stand up and stretch and just get ready for, I guess, to just announce your name, and we'll just have to be gentlemanly and ladylike so we can get in as many questions as we can.
Oh, you got to open it to all of them, don't you?
Sadly, I do.
You don't have an operator to cue them in.
I don't have an operator.
Oh, God. Okay, well, this should be interesting.
This will be interesting, but here's what we're going to do. Once we get one, then we'll mute out the rest of the call while you answer it. So,
that'll be fun. Okay.
It is fun. I've done this before. But I also wanted to say that you recommended some suggested reading. So we have homework before the next call, which is a week from today, Tuesday, October 11th, the same time, from 8 to 10 Eastern. And what Dan suggests is that you read the section on takeaway selling in his No BS Sales book. And that's also part of the resource package, and also Robert Ringer's book, To Be Intimidated or Not to Be Intimidated, and that's at Amazon. I don't have that one. I'm going to pick that one up, but I have your No BS Sales book. So,
yeah, they're both at Amazon, by the way.
They both are. Okay, excellent. So I'll have those titles up also on the when I send out the autoresponders about the call-in time. And to remind you to go to the website to order the resource, because I can only keep it up till 3 p.m. tomorrow, and that's at red-hot-copy.com/dkdiscount.htm. So get ready to yell, and I'm going to unmute you. All right. So we should have everybody there. Say hi.
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 There they are. Yay. All right. So somebody just jump in. Say your first name, and I'll call on you.
Hi. My name's Diane.
Diane.
Diane Evely. And I got as far as an agreement or proposal to somebody after we had a lengthy conversation, and I pretty much, you know, gave him the plan and all this stuff like Dan's suggesting. And then, you know, I'm just not hearing from him at all. And then I followed up with, you know, just a little email about the 40% conversion rate I got from another thing. And suddenly he came up with a piece of the project. And then, again, I hear nothing. What should I just forget about him? He seems like a potential good client in terms of his product and potential there.
Well, let me say several things. First of all, I would neuter out of your language the word proposal.
Okay.
If you must do them, call them action plans.
Okay.
But really, you should be doing an agreement. And so that meeting should have ended with a verbal agreement of what was going to be done, and you only going back to put it in writing. Secondly, we're going to talk next week about these initial meetings, because they shouldn't be free. You tend to get better results when they aren't. As to your specific question with this client, if the nudge of, hey, look what happened last week, brought him back out of the woods and got him going, then there's no reason to assume that another nudge won't do it again, and another nudge won't do it again. And there's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, good client prospects ought to be on a continuous contact program, and we're going to talk about that next week too, so that they are being fed all the time your demonstrations of your expertise and examples of your work and success stories on a continuous basis. So if you nudged him once and you got a satisfactory result, by all means, nudge him again and get another result. I wouldn't give up on them. And look, I've had clients not this way, where there's been an initial meeting and an agreement, but where there has been some discussion. They booked a telephone appointment and then haven't followed through. Or we've had conversation face-to-face at an event and they haven't followed through. And I've had that happen 3 or 4 times over 3 or 4 years before finally getting a project. And, you know, that's how you keep your pipeline full. Last year I did work for the first time for somebody who I saw at a conference every year for 6 years. And every year he took me aside, had a conversation with me, and as soon as you get back to the office, you know, have Vicki let me know, have somebody let me know when you have consulting days available, because we got to get together and I got to do this project. And we had the same conversation every year for 6 years. I thought it was amusing. After 6 years, guess what? He hired me. The good news is the rate was a whole lot more than it was if he had done it the first time around. But so there's nothing wrong with what you're doing now that with him, now that you're in the soup with him that you are. And generally speaking, you want to maintain contact with prospective clients who you've identified could have value. And so that's the right thing to do as well. But you're going to change the way you do your initial process as a result of what we talk about next week.
Okay, great. The last thing I sent to him was what I thought was an agreement. We talked on the phone. He said, yeah, do this, so I sent him the agreement and haven't heard back from him.
Just
keep in contact, I guess, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and again, your initial, it probably has to do with a lot of things. It probably has to do with how you got him in the first place. It probably has to do with there being no deadline after which the agreement is null and void.
Mm.
you know, this is more a positioning issue probably than it is anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I'll say about all this is that you become emboldened with deal flow. And it's very, very important to set in motion enough things so that you have 20 and 30 of these, not two.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's sort of the equivalent, when my stepdaughter had her first kid, if the kid worked, everybody was in the room to check on it, and they were rushing it off to the doctor. By the time she had her third kid, you know, the kid's pretty much got to set fire to the living room before anybody pays much attention. And when you've only got one or two prospects, the energy is all wrong. And you're paying too much attention to each one of them and worrying about them. If you got 20, if this guy didn't convert for 6 months, you wouldn't notice.
Mm-hmm.
So most consultants, and I put copywriters in the group, don't set in motion a lot of deal flow. They like work to get one, and then they do the work. And then they have none, and they start looking for another one, as opposed to having a constant system of 10 or 20 or 30 things to generate business working all the time so that the pipeline's full. So we'll talk about that on the next call, too.
Thank you.
If there's anyone with background noise, you can press *6 to mute yourself out, because otherwise it's pretty quiet, and I'd like to have the interaction. So somebody else want to ask Dan a question? Say your name.
Yeah, this is Kathy.
Hey, Kathy.
Hi. I wanted to know about the consultant in liability insurance.
Any halfway decent property and casualty guy can write it. It's nothing unordinary. There's a number of carriers that provide it, so any independent insurance agent can write the policy. It's quite possible your regular property casualty guy can do it. Most insurance guys are so bad at their business that he's never bothered to realize what business you're in or to recommend it. Like all insurance, of course, it has 512 weasel clauses, and if there ever is a problem, they will do their damnedest not to pay off on it. But nevertheless, it's one piece of the fortress, and it's very inexpensive. You literally buy it by the $1 million. For small money. And, you know, it basically is designed to protect you against liability suits based upon the advice that you've dispensed or the work product that you have delivered. And so any good commercial insurance agent can explain it to you in writing.
Great. Cool. Did that help, Kathy?
Yes, thank you.
Awesome. Anybody else?
We got that one person on the call who's either got a death rattle or he's fixing his transmission. You know, everybody else is perfect, and this one guy.
Sounds typing. Like they're on a keyboard.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Yes. You know what? That is what it is.
Yes. Typing. Yeah.
It's something. See,
they're
by the way,
in my coaching groups,
I unplug all that crap. You know, you come to me, you take notes on a legal thing.
But it's just like $100 if the cell phone goes off, right?
Yep. Okay, question. Question?
I'll ask one.
Good.
This is Tony. How you doing, Dan?
I'm good, Tony. How are you? You're probably the last one.
Okay. With my existing clients that I'm charging fees for my projects, what is a savvy way to now start introducing royalties without pissing them off?
Yeah, well, there is no good answer to that question. And by the way, there's no law on the planet that says you can't grandfather a client and change the policy for the next new one.
Okay.
And that is probably what you're going to wind up doing, because you almost have to be okay with losing the ones you got in order to make the switch.
Okay.
So the first thing to do is re-engineer what you're doing with every new one from here on out.
Which I will do.
Okay, and then the next answer is to consider selectively switching over the clients you have, starting with the ones you care least about. you simply do it and you write a hell of a sales letter, which hopefully you're capable of doing, about why this is better but necessary. And, you know, one of the selling points about it is that you're now in the game. And so as opposed to, if I'm a client, as opposed to me paying you to deliver X and getting X, and you're now going home and not sweating it, you're now in the game. And my clients are under royalty agreements. I'll tweak as long as they're testing. I'll modify when results warrant. So if the results start to slip, I'll tweak that piece in order to extend its life.
Right.
And periodically, you know, I'll discuss with them what's going on, what the results are, what we might do to test now against our own control. And so this puts you in the game. It's also, you want to position it as an alternative to fee increases. So it's the lesser of the bad news. But that's the best answer I got for you.
Meaning that if they don't go the
way... Well, I mean, yeah, it's, you know, the time has come when I have to substantially raise my fees. And I could simply raise the fees, or I could go to a formula that is fairer to the client because it keeps the fee at a modest and affordable level, project by project by project, and then has me getting my profit from success the same way you do.
Okay.
And so you make it appear to be a more reasonable approach.
Okay.
And for many clients, by the way, it is, because whatever zeros you want to use, but if we took my fee and I didn't charge a royalty, I charge three times the fee. And that would literally bar some people from ever using me, where now they can, because the ante to get in the game is not prohibitive. The rest of the money, they're paying me out of money they're making. So, you know, if I make you a million, how happy are you to give me 100K of it?
Right. Okay.
You'll find, by the way, that like royalty agreements and percentage above base agreements are not all that hard for people to swallow because it's money they don't have. And so they really don't think a lot about it at the time that they're doing it. And by the way, that's another way to go back to your old clients is to do a percentage above base arrangement. Okay?
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And right. Lori, I think that's going to... We can try and squeeze one in if you want.
That'd be great if there's another one out there. The short one.
Yeah, hello. This is Kathy again.
Hi, Kathy.
Again?
Oh, hello?
Go ahead, Kathy.
Yeah, I just want to... when you mentioned that if you do a royalty agreement, you get permission to go in and audit. Are there some of the smaller businesses might be a little nervous about it? Are there any alternative ways to, and have you ever had to actually go in and audit?
I've never had to do it. I've had to threaten it.
Okay.
And if somebody was nervous about that clause, I'd be gone in a hot second.
Okay.
Okay? Because you have nothing to fear if you're going to be honest. And quite frankly, it's less onerous for a small business than it is for a large business. I've never actually even had, of the things that they balk over, I've never really had them balk at this. This has just never been a discussion.
Oh, thank you.
Good deal. All right, well, we are at the end of the time now. I will be sending out messages to you all about what to do next, about our next call and where to go, and that you have till 3 p.m. to take advantage of Dan's offer. Thank you, Dan. That's a $600 savings, which is very cool. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And thank you for being on the call and sharing so much amazing information. I'm really honored to have you here.
Okay. Next week, we'll spend all our time on where they are and how to get them.
Awesome. And if anybody has any feedback for me, go ahead and email it to me, and I'll get what I can on to Dan if it's pertinent. So thanks, everyone. Have a great evening.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.